Welcome to The Deeper You Dive, a show where we take a deep dive into one record per season. A couple things before we begin. First, I'd like to shout out Dissect Podcast. Cole Kushner, the creator, is amazing, and that podcast changed my life for the better. If you've never heard of Dissect, be sure to give it a listen. Second, I'd like to talk about the mission of this podcast. I created this podcast for myself. That may sound strange, but creating this podcast encouraged me to give my absolute all to a record, and it has already been so worthwhile. While we will analyze the meaning of the lyrics of this record, I want to stress something. My goal is not to tell you that this means this or that means that. Yes, the goal of the podcast is to unearth the meaning behind the artist's lyrics, but there will be many different interpretations present. It is my belief that any good piece of art cannot be pinned down to one or even several meanings. What it means to one person can be totally different than what it means to another person. Not only is that okay, that's really profound and allows for the piece of art to be impactful. Throughout this podcast, you might hear some stuff that you think is fundamental and didn't need to be explained, and you also might hear some stuff you consider to be a stretch. In my opinion, a key part of songwriting is ambiguity, never revealing too much of the picture, but just enough to paint the silhouette of what you are trying to describe, giving the listener the opportunity to fill in the blanks. I think the goal of this podcast is to function almost like a class analyzing a short story, and I intend to present all the information and interpretations I can to allow you to formulate your own opinions on the piece. At some points you may disagree with my interpretations, and I would like to encourage that. I did a lot of research that has enabled me to support some of these claims and interpretations, but at the end of the day, what is most important is what it means to you. Two more things. First, be sure to follow on Instagram at The Deeper You Dive and Twitter at TDYD Podcast. I've teamed up with an artist who has provided us this wonderful cover art, as well as a couple illustrations for each episode, so definitely follow on social media so you don't miss out. Lastly, this episode will provide background information regarding the artist and the events in their life leading up to the release of the album. Nothing in this world exists without context, and it is imperative to understand the circumstances that led to the release of the project. That means this episode is going to be full of me rattling off information about the artist. Because this episode doesn't analyze any of the music, a bonus episode where we analyze a song that is not on this record will be released 2 days after this episode. The song we analyze will provide context to important themes present throughout this season's album, so make sure to give it a listen. After week one, the norm will be one episode released per week. Without further ado, let's dive in. Season 1's album is going to be Joanna Newsom's 2006 epic, East, a 55-minute, breathtaking record which sees Joanna's songwriting on full display as she navigates her way through the challenges in her life. Though not a concept album, the songs and even the cover art share many themes and ideas that make it very much a singular piece of art. Throughout the season, we will note the musical landscapes upon which the lyrics exist, but the goal of the podcast is to analyze the lyrics first and foremost. If you have never heard this record, that's okay. You can listen to this episode and gain a wealth of knowledge on a totally new artist to you, though I would encourage you to listen to the record yourself before listening to any subsequent episodes. Joanna's discography is on Apple Music, Amazon Prime, and Tidal, but she is famously not on Spotify, calling it the rotten banana peel of the music industry. If you are a Spotify user who has Prime, I encourage you to stream through Amazon for free. Otherwise, you can always purchase the digital album for $9 on Bandcamp. Joanna Newsom was born on January 18, 1982, in Grass Valley, California. Joanna grew up the middle child of the family, with an older brother, Peter, and a younger sister, Emily. As a child, Joanna was not allowed to watch television or listen to the radio. She described her parents as idealists when it came to trying to protect them from bad influences. Instead of those activities, Joanna did things like poetry Easter egg hunts, which would see her and her brother running around the yard picking up scraps of paper with a word on them, and from that word they would have to create a poem around it. Joanna has expressed that she believes her parents pushed their children to be so creatively driven because they were both doctors, speculating that they were slightly deprived of creativity in their own work, so they encouraged their kids to pursue their creative passions from a young age. Though not allowed to listen to the radio, Joanna was exposed to music early in her life. Her brother played guitar and drums, her mother played piano as well as drums, her father played guitar, and her sister played the cello. Despite the amount of interviews where Joanna says she began playing harp at the age of 8, in a more recent live show in Los Angeles, she admitted she was mistaken and that she began at the age of 10. She would later joke about making her career with the most impractical instrument imaginable. In a 2015 interview with Rolling Stone, she talked about how a teacher once taught her a way of thinking about the harp that stuck with her. Quote, "The idea is that the left hand is very grounded, playing a steady 1-2-3-4 beat, and that's the earth. But your right hand is doing a 1-2-3 that never grounds, never resolves, and that's heaven. It was mind-melting. Heaven and earth come together every 12 beats." End quote. From the age of 10 onwards, Joanna never stopped playing the harp. After high school, Joanna went to Mills College, where she began studying composition. Joanna had always thought she would be a composer, but upon taking a few classes, she found that she felt out of place. In a 2006 interview with Pitchfork, Joanna said, quote, "I ended up going to Mills College to study it because a lot of composers I really liked had gone there or taught there or had some sort of affiliation with that school. The second I got there, I realized that what I was doing was completely separate from the dialogue taking place in the school at that time. And I think that is when I started struggling to reconcile where my music fit in. Not that it needs to fit in, but what should I even call it? Should I call them songs now, or can I still call them compositions? My music generally retains an interest in melody and harmony, and some sort of meter. It might be polymeter, but some sort of meter that repeats for more than one bar. But a lot of these ideas that I was interested in seemed to be considered passé, like they were unworthy of discussion and unworthy of listening. I wouldn't necessarily say that would be true of the professors at that school, but the climate was dictated by what the students were interested in, and most of them were writing incredibly dissonant music on their laptop computers and didn't play instruments or know how to write notation. It was a whole different thing than I thought it would be, and it might have been smarter to go to a less experimental composition school where I would have gotten neoclassical training in composition. After a few years, I left the music program and went to study creative writing instead, which in a way I'm really grateful for, because I think that sense of alienation drove me to feel like I could go even further in the direction I'd been embarrassed of previously. An obsession with melody, rather than a rejection of it. An analysis of every interval that separates every note that follows in succession. In 2002 and 2003, Joanna was in the band The Pleased, appeared on Nervous Cop's self-titled album, and made two solo EPs, titled Walnut Whales and Yarn and Glue. These EPs are extremely rare to find anywhere, and it is said that they were not intended for public release. Despite this, Joanna's boyfriend at the time encouraged her to hand out a few of the EPs. Newsom's friend, Adam Klein, ended up giving an EP to Will Oldham, a folk and alternative country artist, who then gave the EP to his label Drag City. Drag City was impressed enough to offer her a record deal, and a few months later in 2004, we got Joanna's debut album, The Milk-Eyed Mender. The Milk-Eyed Mender was a polarizing release. Folk and indie music was at the front of the music scene at the time, and many people were opinionated on it. Half of the people hailed it as one of the better debuts of the year, the other half declared it an abomination. If you listen to the album, you might understand how opinion was so divided. A positive review by AllMusic said, quote, "Newsom's childlike voice brings an unstudied grace to an innocent setting of songs, and such quirkiness is hard to find among most guitar-driven indie acts. Delicate harp arrangements are nicely sprinkled among specks of pianos, organs, and a harpsichord, only adding to the fascination that is Milk-Eyed Mender. Newsom exists in several musical spheres while not forgetting how wonderful it is to live in a warm place that leaves you bright-eyed and hopeful for only what is good in life." End quote. A not-so-positive reviewer on Rate Your Music had this to say, quote, "When I was presented with a copy of The Milk-Eyed Mender, I accepted it under the assumption that it was full of music and melody. I wish I knew why this whatever it is hated me so much. It's not like I did anything to provoke Joanna Newsom. I don't even know her." End quote. On Milk-Eyed Mender, Joanna's voice is more akin to the squawk of a bird than the voice of an angel, but it has its own charm. The rawness of the vocals fits well with the instrumentation and the lyrical content of the album. It is unique and untrained. Some people took to Joanna's sound and others hated it. Though she obviously tried to block out the noise, it is inevitable that at some points it gets to her. In a 2015 interview with The Guardian, Joanna said, quote, "I've ranted about this in the past, so I don't want to get too much into it again. I'm trying to think of a male musician I've ever been compared to. Like early, early days Devendra Banhart. He and I had some aesthetic similarities. The music was pulling in some ways to a similar place. but where for him people would use words like eccentric or psychedelic, for me they'd use fairy tales and unicorns, end quote. She's right. Male artists have often been praised for their weird quirks in their voice, whereas women in the industry are seemingly bound to this idea that their voice should be perfectly trained and naturally beautiful. This is not the only time Joanna expresses her struggles as a woman, and we will see femininity will come to play a key role in our album analysis. To preface this, a bonus episode will be released later this week where we break down Joanna's song, Colleen, from her 2007 EP, Joanna Newsom and the East Street Band, so stay tuned for that. Remember, Joanna began as a composer and a writer. Those are the two things she studied at school. Singing happened very abruptly for her. It was not something that she had been training her whole life to do. In an interview with Arthur Magazine, Joanna said, quote, "I was so sure that I didn't know how to sing that I was just going balls out. I was like, I'm going to sing my heart out, as crazy as it sounds, and I'm not going to care because there's no hope of sounding anything like what people consider beautiful," end quote. The difference in her vocal performance on East versus the Milk-Eyed Mender cannot be overstated. It is so distinct. Some people prefer the rawness of her expression in Milk-Eyed Mender, but it can hardly be denied that she grew more into her voice on East. Even at the young age of 22, Joanna's songwriting was very clearly her strength, and she quickly developed a cult-like fan base. Joanna was young at the time, but she had already had a moment of maturity occur in the middle of her senior year of high school. That year, she went to the river closest to her house, where she set up a circle of rocks to sit in for 3 days, only eating rice and drinking water brought to her by her friends. In a 2010 interview with the New York Times, Joanna said that she was so delirious on the third day that she thought she was hallucinating 3 wolves in front of her, but that they turned out to be very much real as they came up and licked her face. Take it up with Joanna if you don't believe this. Don't shoot the messenger. In a 2006 interview with Arthur Magazine, Joanna said that the experience completely changed her life. When she got back, she would pick up the paper and read of a man dying in a car crash and cry about it for the rest of the day. She said, quote, "I was an infantile, drunken mess," end quote. Just from that, we can see Joanna had trouble coming to grips with the dark and cruel side of life. In Milk-Eyed Mender, that seems to manifest itself in her determination to see the good in life, never diving too deep into the depressive side of whatever she is exploring. We can see how those 4 years after her spiritual event changed her, from not being able to stop crying about a man dying in a car crash to an insistence on seeing things glass half full. The year following the release of her debut album, 4 events occurred that would change Joanna's life forever. On this podcast, we will unearth what those 4 events were, as each has a song about the specific event on East, and the extra song is Joanna's effort at tying all of these events together. On East, Joanna partnered with Van Dyke Parks, a renowned musician and arranger. When she requested to work with Van Dyke Parks, Joanna was not keenly aware of what a large ask that was. Drag City didn't shoot her down. Instead, they reached out to Van Dyke, and he entertained the idea. He invited Joanna to his hotel at the time, where they talked, and she performed the songs that would eventually end up on the record for him, and he agreed to work with her. This proved a rather difficult task because of Joanna's variation in the tempo of her music. Joanna recorded her parts of East without a click track. A click track is a series of audio cues used to synchronize the recording. While this works well for Joanna alone, it is almost impossible to write the score for an orchestra without some sort of click track. There are so many people playing that they need to be synchronized by something. To account for this, Joanna recorded her pieces alone, just her and her harp. Parks then had to transfer her recording into a digital file, place a click track on it, and line it up to something approximate to the tempo and time changes of Joanna's performance. In other words, Joanna Newsom is an extremely difficult artist to write an orchestral score for. In fact, it took 6 months of constant drafting and discussion between Parks and Newsom to finally get it right, but thank goodness they did it. The orchestration on this album complements the concepts and themes Joanna navigates lyrically. The strings paired with Joanna's fantastical songwriting makes for a record that truly feels larger than life. In my opinion, where the Milk-Eyed Mender is a collection of songs Joanna wrote because she wanted to make a record, East is a collection of songs she absolutely had to make. Oftentimes, when a traumatic event occurs in the life of a young person, there is an inability to face it or process it fully. Grief can manifest in many strange ways, and it isn't uncommon for these coping mechanisms to exist externally from the reality we exist in, the reality where these events happened. However strange the coping mechanisms may be, only by doing these things can the events be fully processed. Yeast is an intricate fantasy that is developed and rooted in these very real events that occurred. This feeling of fantasy is crystallized by the vinyl of the album, which is designed to be like a storybook with the lyrics of the album printed on pages you can leaf through on the inside of the record, accompanied by small sketches to go with the songs. In a 2006 interview with The Wire, Joanna said this of the album, quote, "And this is an image I hate to use, because it reminds me of things people say about my music that I like the least, but the image that came to my mind was something very detailed and delicate, like a dollhouse built out of toothpicks or something like that. And it took me months and months, and I had a bunch of other people helping, like I had an architect, and I had a draft person, a contractor, and all these, Jim O'Rourke, Steve Albini, Van Dyke Parks, and my label who helped me so much, and the orchestral players. I had so many things in place that allowed me to make this little house, and when I was done, I couldn't help. I was just bellowing and weeping for weeks after I finished this project because it was just so huge for me, and I was so overwhelmed by how everything had come together, and it was exactly the way I wanted it to be." End quote. The title of this record was the last edition before its release. Joanna had written and recorded all of the songs, the cover art was completed, but she needed a title. She reportedly wanted it to be a short title, preferably one syllable, contrasting the incredibly detailed and meticulous cover art as well as the lengthy nature of the songs off of this record. In the 2006 interview with The Wire, Joanna also said that she was dreaming of the letters Y and S. "I personally have never dreamed about specific letters, but hey, I'm not Joanna Newsom." Upon stumbling into the French Celtic myth of the lost city of Ys, Joanna was shocked to find how perfectly it fit. Though not contrived in any manner, many themes and ideas on the album were shared with those presented in the myth of Ys. I'm going to give a brief overview of the myth so as to familiarize you all with it. There are a couple different versions of the myth, but here is a solid rundown. The myth begins when King Gradlon of the city of Cornwall is visited by the Queen of the North named Maelgwn. She encourages Gradlon to kill her husband, and upon doing so, the two mount a magical horse and ride out to sea. The two stayed at sea for a year, and one day, Maelgwn gave birth to a daughter named Dihut. Upon giving birth to the child, Queen Maelgwn dies. Gradlon and his daughter return to Cornwall, but soon enough, Dihut asks Gradlon to build her a city near the sea. Gradlon builds the city and names it Ys. The city is surrounded by a great wall to keep out the vicious tide of the ocean. There is only one gate in or out of the city, to which Gradlon alone holds the key. As Dihut becomes older, she grows into a beautiful young woman who enchants men with her songs. It is said that she then makes a pact with the powers of the sea itself. Each day, Dihut has a new engaged, and each night she puts a mask on them to cover their face. Every morning, at the sound of the song of a meadowlark, springs activate inside the mask and cut the man's throat, whose body is then cast into the sea. In return, the sea brings plentiful sailors to make the city rich. Because of Dihut's actions, Ys is viewed as a place of debauchery by Christians. One day, a particularly handsome knight decked in red armor wins Dihut's favor. Dihut is so enthralled by him that she does not make him put on the mask. That night, the sea rages against the walls of the city, and the knight convinces Dihut to steal her father's key while he is sleeping. Upon opening the gate, the red knight reveals himself to be the devil, and the waves from the sea rip through the city. Dihut runs to her father and begs for them to get on the magical horse and ride to sea. Gradlon takes her and mounts the steed, but the waves are too strong even for the horse. Then, Gradlon is confronted by Saint Gwenyol, who says to him that he must drop the princess in order to live. Gradlon pushes his daughter to the sea, and the waves engulf her, drowning Dihut and all of the city's inhabitants. Gradlon rides to a city named Kemper, which he makes his new capital. It is said that Dihut was transformed into a mermaid, and she appears to fishermen, combing her long hair and persuading them to fall into the sea. It is also said that when the weather is very quiet, you can still hear the ringing of the bells from the drowned city of Ys. Throughout this season, we will discover many parallels between Joanna's album and the myth of Ys. It is important to remember that this did not happen on purpose. As I said previously, the songs were entirely finished by the time she discovered the myth's existence. The fact that none of these parallels were purposeful does not take away from the genius of them, but rather adds to the mysterious and mythical feel of this record. That concludes this episode of The Deeper You Dive. Next episode, we take a brief glimpse at Joanna's song Colleen off of her EP. And then next week, we dive right into the album's first track, Emily.